again, this is part of the reason why I'm so horrified, because we're playing with matches in an environment in which we really don't understand how much fuel is in the warehouse with us, right? We just truly do not understand it. And I would argue that our leaders at the Fed in particular are intentionally obtuse.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview with portfolio manager Mike Green. If you haven't yet watched part one of our discussion with Mike, in which he explains why it will be almost impossible to avoid a painful recession in 2023, head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. Mike also generously shares how he's allocating capital in his professional portfolios for the turbulent times he sees ahead, so be sure to stick around to hear that. Okay, let's get started watching part two of our interview with Mike Green.
I just think the bullish case on China is ridiculous. China in 2013 made a choice that they were not going to reopen in the framework of the Soviet Union under perestroika and glasnost, that they were going to move in the opposite direction on the J curve, right, which is the political stability dynamic, and move back towards a totalitarian and socialist component. You can see this very clearly in the data. It makes perfect sense, particularly when you understand the true demographics of China, where their labor force began to contract in 2012. And has been falling for a decade. Their population has now turned negative. Apparently they've lost 100 million people, right? Literally their census has lost 100 million people.
Yep. That's what a one-child policy does to you, but yeah.
Well, what I'm actually saying is that their census miscounted 100 million people. So their population is not 1.4 billion people, it's 1.3 billion people. And for political reasons, they refuse to admit that they're now smaller than India, right? So, like, that gives you some idea of the extent of the chaos that has existed in China for over a decade. They, by and large, anytime a country faces an internal contraction in population like that, remember, an economy is just people doing favors for other people. So if you reduce the number of people, the bias should be towards fewer favors and an economy contracts.
Right. Hey, and I'm sorry, but just to clarify, because it's an important point, did the population contract in reality, or did it just contract on paper, meaning were the previous censuses bad and it was a readjustment that went down, or literally because of their policies, they've actually lost that 100 million people?
Both. So it appears that they overstated their population significantly, and it now appears that their absolute population numbers are contracting.
Okay. And that's a big deal, because everybody still thinks of China as this growth powerhouse from a population standpoint.
Right. And so, you can just think about that in the absolute simplest form of, humans need a certain amount of calories to stay alive. And beyond that, it's a function of, again, back to the relative prices, do I want to have better quality calories or lower quality calories? And some of those better quality are obviously bad for you, right? Saturated fats, et cetera. China is now in contraction mode, and it is going to shrink for the rest of our foreseeable lives. It's entirely plausible that China's population falls by 50% over the next 30 years.
My God.
That's a staggering number.
Yeah.
There is no growth in that scenario. And in all likelihood, there's significant contraction. Now, what China has functionally done since 2013 has tried to substitute internal consumption growth. What Michael Pettis and other very smart observers of China have talked about is a rebalancing that could have occurred had China been allowed to grow rich, but that would have been at the expense of the CCP. And as a result, they've increasingly turned it into a modern penal colony. What you're seeing me refer to in my tweets is the fact that we're watching the dynamics of the Soviet Union from 1929 until basically 1952, when Stalin was replaced, right, or Stalin died. It is turning into a penal colony. I realize how offensive that sounds, but look at the actual data of what's happening. The revolts are happening from workers who are locked into factories. Think about that for a second. They're not able to work. They're not able to make incomes for their family. They're not able not to. These are slaves. That's a really strong statement. I understand that, but that is actually what is happening. And we Westerners are complicit in our use of iPhones and everything else. Now, they are rapidly moving away. India is taking over, We're doing all these things, but this is really important for people to understand. And it's part of the reason why I'm putting out offensive statements like linking what's happening in Xinjiang or happening in these uprisings to the Holodomor in Ukraine in under Stalin, right? The export quotas have to be met. That means that the domestic consumption has to be penalized.
So this is a question for a full interview on this topic, but the prospects for China, I assume, get even worse as hopefully the Western world begins to really wake up to this and say, you know what, we gotta friendshore, we gotta change our, you know, trade relationships, et cetera, not even just for supply chain resilience and all that type of stuff, but because we can't be supporting a regime like this, right? So you've got a population that's in contraction mode, and you've got its economic partnerships contracting away from it as well, right? I mean, that's just got to spell a really bad future for China.
Yeah, no, it is a terrible, terrible future.
Okay, which is you know, again, I'm painting with a broad brush here, but I think in most people's minds still, they still have the like, China's the one part of the world. It's the hottest part of the engine of the global economy. It grows every year at 7%+. One day we're all going to be, you know, serfs to our Chinese overlords. You're basically saying that's really a fiction, folks.
I think it's a giant fiction. I've been calling it that for over a decade now.
Okay. God, I could talk about it forever. I'm going to hop to topic number two, and then we're going to land the plane here together, Mike. So you just recorded a discussion on George Noble's program where you were in deep conversation with a guy who goes by the moniker Bitfinext.
Yeah.
And you guys were talking about the unfolding FTX scandal, which still seems to surprise us nearly every day with some new mind-boggling or mind-blowing development. I'm just curious, and you know, on the day we're talking here, BlockFi, a very prominent crypto lender, they just declared bankruptcy. We it seemed like this might be another shoe to drop, but it indeed is dropping today. What were your key takeaways from that conversation, and anything you want to say just at a high level, because I can't give you a lot of time to say about the implications and the repercussions of this implosion at FTX?
Well, unfortunately, I think crypto and Bitcoin as it exists today, particularly the dynamics of Bitcoin maximalism, exhibit all the characteristics that we're talking about with China, et cetera, right? Now, remember that China is supported by the labor of 1.3 billion Chinese and therefore can last quite a bit longer. Something like crypto is effectively a very small universe that is structurally Ponzi. There is no mechanism for money to be created within the system. And so it constantly needs to draw in money from outside. When, you know, what's referred to as the bezel, right? When the fraud, et cetera, is released, that lowers the flow of money. It creates increasingly desperate behavior. And again, what we're just seeing in crypto is the delayed or the realization that it had already died last year. Mm-hmm. Right. Now you have all sorts of people running around and saying, well, Bitcoin is different, et cetera. It's just not true. Bitcoin mechanically is an accounting system, right? You are paying miners to build a database of record, right? You need to continue to inject fiat currency into that system. And the only way that would actually be supported is if there was a system of taxation or if there was a system of genuine wealth creation that doesn't exist. The size of these economies is fantastically small. Now, some of them, for example, Ethereum, and I'm not going to highlight Ethereum as a good investment. I just want to highlight that it has the potential. You know, they are creating themselves as effectively a token that is required for proof of stake, where you put at risk capital, which could be dollars, it could be Ethereum, it could be anything. It just happens to be native to that, to the, you know, the effectively the execution of legal contracts, smart contracts, right? There's some potential that exists within that if it is broadly accepted and people decide that they're going to migrate transactions there, but there's just no real evidence that that's happening yet, right? And so the system is currently imploding on its own hype and its own fraud, which is what I've been calling out for years and years against this. I think it's wonderful that people are trying to develop new technology and recognizing the importance of digital securities, right? Natively digital securities. I often pull out, I don't think I have it on my desk right now because my desk is covered with all sorts of garbage, but it, you know, I often pull out a paper check that I received because my children, their grandmother bought them physical stock certificates to frame on their wall, right? Their father's involved in the stock market. You know, I'm going to buy you Nintendo shares. What that means is I get checks for one penny, physical checks for one penny. The cost of issuing a check is somewhere around a dollar, right? So this is a negative 99 cent, you know, loss on the system. In a digital, truly natively digital security, that just doesn't have to happen, right? And so we will eventually move to that type of framework. But that's true for any fraud. It requires an element of truth in the system, right? This is the future. Well, yes, there are parts of that that are true. But all the other extraneous bullshit, right, is a misrepresentation of things like Austrian monetary theory and the belief that gold actually has some intrinsic value to it, et cetera, right? So I'm sure I've horrified the other half of your audience that, you know, tuned out on me when I did the interview with Yaron Brooks already, right? But the simple reality is that those misunderstandings underpin what we're seeing right now, which is just an extraordinary contraction in the space and the revealing of all the frauds and misrepresentations that occurred.
Okay. So many threads on that to pull that I'm just not going to be able to here. So we'll leave that as sort of your declarative statements there. We're very clearly going to get beaten up by both the China bulls and the Bitcoin bulls after this, Mike. But I'm sure hopefully you'll be up for the dialogue to come back on at some point.
I'm more than happy to have a discussion with people who want to have a thoughtful, polite discussion around it.
Okay. Well, I hope this is the channel for that. So when it does happen, we'll have it here. All right. Well, look, first, I want to thank you for giving us so much time. Like I said, we're going to land the plane together here. So last questions really just are around your outlook for the markets going forward in the next year. And then again, if we can just get a reminder or a refresher of what you're thinking of doing from a capital allocation standpoint. But I guess as we look to the markets for next year, you said you think a recession is highly likely. I'm guessing, correct me if I'm wrong, that you think the bear market that began this year, and it's so funny to me, like you even made the comment that this has been, you know, one of the worst markets for stocks and bonds in many, many years, and it has collectively. But at the time you and I were talking, Mike, what's the Dow down? I mean, I don't even think it's down double digits yet. I mean, I think the S&P is down what right now? Like maybe 12, 13% for the year?
No, the S&P is down 16 and change. But but I mean, that is one of the interesting and deceptive components to it, right? Which is, you know, it if I go back a couple of days ago, you're correct that, you know, the S&P and Dow were barely down double digits. I don't know what the Dow is down.
I don't know. And actually, I haven't seen the markets today, so it sounds like it's a down day.
It is a down day. But
But the point is it's not, these are not Armageddon, the world is ending numbers, but because we've had such a long stretch of tranquil, you know, liquidity supported, you know, inexorable rises in the markets over the past decade, this feels like Armageddon to a lot of people.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I, you know, again, I would just draw people's attention to the similar pattern of an elevated, but non-spiky or non, cathartic level of equity volatility, right? So if I look back at this, this looks exactly like the period from basically the summer of 2006, when the quant quake, which nobody is old enough to remember anymore, occurred. And you basically saw an unanticipated unwind of many factors cause firms like AQR, et cetera, to suffer, right? That was the kicking off of a period of higher volatility that never really retreated. And we stayed in that range all the way through September, you know, through August of 2008, when finally the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the failure of the US government to step in and backstop the system led to the cathartic events that we began to see. I just think something similar is underway, that we're seeing a very high level of sustained volatility without the sort of cleansing of positions that would indicate capitulation. And it strikes me as inevitable given the interventionist behavior from the Fed and the challenges that exist out there, that we're going to break something, truly break something. My biggest fear is all the dynamics that we're talking about, right? Remember, what pulled us out of 2008 were two really important things. One, the Fed lowered interest rates to such an extent that those who held homes were able to refinance their mortgages and dramatically lower their monthly expenses. Mm-hmm. That doesn't exist now. There is no scenario under which that can occur. Something like $5.5 trillion worth of Fannie debt is outstanding with a coupon level of around 3%.
Yep.
Right. To get that to refinance, we have to lower mortgage rates below 2.5, which means functionally tens need to go back below 1%, and you need to get credit spreads to tighten. That's a really challenging environment.
I mean, that's like a negative nominal Fed funds rate at that point in time, right?
Pretty darn close, right? That's a really, really hard nut to crack. The second thing that happened in that environment is China stimulated, right? And China still had the potential to stimulate under those conditions. I actually took my family on a tour of China in early 2009, specifically to understand what was underway. And it was very similar to our COVID dynamics, massive amounts of money printing, et cetera. Right. That potential really doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. And I've mentioned this recently, too. I just want to underscore it, that China really did kind of rescue the global economy coming out of the global financial crisis, because it did not have a lot of debt on a relative basis going into that period. And it decided to really debt finance to lever up going forward after that. Now it has so much debt, it can't do that again.
Correct. Yeah. So, look, this is part of the reason why I'm so horrified, because we're playing with matches in an environment in which we really don't understand how much fuel is in the warehouse with us, right? We just truly do not understand it. And I would argue that our leaders at the Fed in particular are intentionally obtuse.
Intentionally obtuse and fighting amongst each other.
they're engaged in the Game of Thrones, where, you know, a relatively nondescript middle-aged white man who happens to be worth $150 million, largely due to his political connections, is the consummate Washington insider, is embarrassed and trying to show us all how tough he is, right? I mean, strongman competition, my guess is he can't put up more than 100 pounds. And I would argue that his intellectual justifications are roughly as robust.
All right. So from a capital management standpoint, you began telling us a little bit earlier, and then I forced you back into the macro sphere.
Yep.
What do you feel comfortable sharing about what you're doing? And are there certain asset classes you think are, or strategies you think are better for going into this year? Are there ones that you would not touch with a 10-foot pole? You know, what are you thinking?
So, I think what we have largely seen to date has been relative strength this should strike people as very paradoxical, right? Given the increase that we've seen in interest rates, one of the most remarkable things has been the very limited drawdown that we've seen in cyclically exposed, highly levered companies. My index of companies that I track on that basis, I actually didn't look at it today, but let me just pull it up here quickly. On a year-to-date basis, it's down 5.9%. Right, this is among the best performing indices that you can find out there. If I look at the underlying fundamentals of these companies under the current interest rate regime, every single one of them is bankrupt. Right, so this is an index that is sitting at all time, you know, within a few percentage points of all time highs, where every single equity, and this is composed of stocks in the Russell 1000, is bankrupt under current interest rate policy. That's okay. An extraordinary degree of overvaluation.
Yeah. And I'm just curious, can you name a type of sector that some of those companies are from?
So some of them are exposed to things like energy. Again, you know, if China is actually shrinking, I have a hard time imagining that commodities are really where you want to be, but I could be totally wrong on that. But these are largely cyclical industrials, as I said, energy exposure, et cetera. Companies that have limited pricing power, high degrees of leverage, many of them refinanced during the 2020-2021 time period. Their bonds are now deeply, deeply underwater, which makes it almost impossible for them to successfully refinance into the next cycle.
Yeah, so a bunch of zombie companies are in here.
Massive quantities of zombie companies. Right. Shorting those strikes me as, you know, I'll never call something a no-brainer, but pretty darn close to a no-brainer.
Got it.
On the flip side of that, I'm renting U.S. fixed income primarily. If I look at twos and I look at tens, I'm more focused on twos for the very simple reason that I don't think the Fed is going to be able to accomplish their objectives, which are largely priced into fixed income markets now, getting above 5%. If I look at the forward rate on, kind of the 3 month, 3 month is suggesting that the Fed can get north of 5%, as you're highlighting. I think it may get there. I think, through sheer force of will, because Powell can do what he wants, right? We forget that.
But it may
That we
not
may
last.
end up getting there, but that's priced in. And the next move, which is, oh my God, what did we just do, is not yet priced in.
Got it. And sorry, when you say renting, does that just mean that you're kind of parked in funds that buy these things?
By renting, so it's simplified. We have funds that allow us to do this. By renting, I mean that I don't have a firm commitment to it, because again, I think that the Fed's actions have interjected volatility into inflation, which makes interest rates much less attractive on a long-term hold basis.
Got it. But so basically, you're in a liquid fund that if you change your mind tomorrow, you can easily get out of, is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Okay. And we've had a number of folks on this channel recently that have echoed the same strategy, which you're saying, which is that if you are skeptical of the Fed even getting to 5% or getting there, but being able to stay there, and something breaking, and the Fed having to bring, either pivot policy and start cutting rates, or it just breaks something and the world freaks out and capital starts seeking safe haven. Those are all reasons for why bond yields, treasury bond yields could go down, and treasury bond prices would go up.
Yes.
And in certain cases, and I won't put words in your mouth, but in certain cases, if that were to happen relatively extremely on the far end of the curve, the treasury curve, you could get some really pretty substantial price appreciation. And so right now, folks are saying this is actually kind of a pretty interesting place to look, because in the short term, you're just finally getting paid something notable to park in relative safety. And then if indeed we do have this big swing, well, you could make a lot of money on your capital there too.
I think that's correct. I mean, the specific vehicles that we're in, again, I encourage people to check out the Simplify website. We have products that are designed to allow me to invest at the front end of the curve with more exposure than I might have at the back end of the curve. If I look at periods where stuff like this has happened in the past, you have extraordinary volatility in the yield curve slope. Meaning that twos would respond and tens might not respond as much, right? So I actually prefer to own the twos versus the tens, although I own both.
Got it. Okay. All right. So you gave us a great short to look at. You gave us, a good potential long to look at, but with an eye towards, being able to get in or out based upon the dynamics of what happens. Anything else materially that you're looking at?
Yeah, I mean,
And I should say, we have a lot of people that are just saying cash is not a bad place to be,
yeah,
in an
well,
environment
that's
like this.
a, I mean, that's pretty close to what I'm saying when I say the front end of the curve, right? I
Right,
mean,
because it's
that
highly
is,
liquid. Yeah.
so I guess the, no, I mean, I think that's pretty much it. I would just encourage people to understand that when I say these things and I say them with such certainty, right? Like, this is my opinion. It doesn't necessarily reflect Simplify, et cetera. But more importantly, we are now actually truly exploring unexplored territory, right? The 20th century is finally over. The 20th century had some really unique characteristics to it. Global population exploded in a manner that we've never seen before, right?
Yeah,
I highlight
I'm
this.
sorry to interrupt, but what did we start at? Do you know what we started the 20th century? Because I know we just had the 8 billionth person
Yeah.
born like last week.
So we started the 20th century at about 1.5 billion people, about 1 billion people in the global labor force. We ended the 20th century officially in 2000 with about 7.5 billion people, 7.2 billion people, and roughly 5.5 billion people in the global labor force. I'm actually more focused on the second part of it, right? The global labor force. That, quintupling plus of the global labor force is something that has never happened before in history. Right. And actually, one of the charts that I'm starting to write a piece around is the origin of the word or the use of the phrase commodity. right? Which goes back all the way back to Roman times, but didn't even begin to show up in literature until the end of the end of the 19th century and beginning of the and through the 20th century. And it literally looks like the arc of population, because the entire 20th century was unique in its need to source things for a rapidly expanding global population. The 21st century is all about the collapse of that. Right? We're talking about the next 100 years, the global population falling unless we figure out ways to radically lower the cost of raising human beings. And that's a really frightening prospect. Right, so it is fundamentally and deeply deflationary. It's one of the reasons why we need to rethink all the stuff that we take for granted. Right now, I've of course opened something up much, much bigger, but like this, these are the deep realities. And so anyone who tells you they know what's happening has no idea. We truly have no idea.
All right, so just to put some words in your mouth, in periods of high uncertainty, that's not where you want to be adopting necessarily a highly speculative investment strategy.
Yeah, I mean, by definition, those are the, you know, technical terms, those are the ass end of the capital structure, right? So but part of the point that I'm making is like, if US treasuries are gonna fail, man, US equities are not protection, right? Yeah. Like the government has to be funded before anything else. We're seeing that in China. That's what's happening. That's the transition to penal colony, right? They don't let it go quietly. I'm not suggesting the same thing in the United States is inevitable, but unless we start making better policy choices, we could very well end up in a similar situation. I see you putting your head in your hands.
Yeah, well, so this goes back to what I used to do for a living before I started running Wealthion, and this is a really critical topic. I'd love to have you back on and just focus on this, Mike. But is we have had, because of this long arc that you just described of sort of ever rising prosperity in the 20th century, we have evolved a political class that all it knows how to do is distribute the bounty of an ever increasing pie, right? So we don't have any stored memory. We don't have any experience at the political level in how you ration a pie that is not growing, or to your point, maybe even shrinking, right? So we have the exact wrong muscle memory and lived experience of our leaders right now for the type of future that you're describing that we're heading into. So that's why I put my head in my hands here, because I just don't expect better decision-making from that crowd. It's got the exact wrong experience base for the type of future we're heading into, possibly.
I agree with part of that statement. I actually think the biggest risk that we run is the misdiagnosis of the need to ration, rather than the recognition that the potential exists for us to massively multiply human productivity in the same way that we did with physical capability in the transition from the 19th to the 20th century, taking a human being or a horse that could produce one manpower or one horsepower and turning it into a situation in which I've got 400 horsepower sitting under the hood of my totally average car. Right? Like that's an extraordinary multiplication. The 21st century could dwarf that in terms of the growth of intelligence, the growth of capabilities, the growth of productivity. But we lack the will and the vision to do so. And we're actually trapped by leaders, much like the Soviets were in the 1930s, who are forced to say, well, what happened in the past and how could we organize it without the expertise that's required? The entire point around capitalism, to bring this right back to the first part of this conversation, a shift in relative prices is a signal to devote resources. If we try to subsume those and prevent those signals from coming to the economy, we're going to fail. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, personally, I cannot argue with that at all. And I'm knowing the wealthy and audience as I do, you're going to have a lot of people that are right behind you on that one.
That's the first time they're going to like me in this entire conversation.
That is not true at all. You're going to have a lot of fans. I know you've got a lot of fans coming into this, but I know you've won over a bunch of folks through this discussion. You're a very smart guy, Mike. It really all comes down to the fact is will we let market forces and market signals, flourish more than we have to date? I don't know.
We unfortunately know the answer. Under the current crop of leadership, the answer is no.
Right, right. Yeah. What is the old Einstein quote that you can't rely on the same thinking that got you into the problem to get you out of it? or to come up with a solution
together, something like that. Or, you know, there's a variety of those, but yes, I broadly think that that's correct. And I would just, again, highlight, like, you know, if you really want to understand what happened over the last 500 years, as painful as it is, people need to recognize that the discovery of the new world, quote unquote discovery, I understand we displaced Native American tribes and everything else, right? But they were a fraction of the population. We introduced an exit voice. We basically allowed customers of the crown in various places in Europe and Asia to say, screw you, you guys don't know what you're doing. I'm going to go somewhere else. That forced reform, we've lost that. We don't have that capacity today. And so we have to work much, much harder than we ever have in the past to release the same capability, right? Like that possibility is there, but without the exit voice, I'm unfortunately really concerned about it.
All right. Well, Mike, I'd love to have a conversation with you. And I know I've already identified like 5 or 10 so far, but about with just, hey, we were to make you emperor. What policies, what reforms would you want to most embrace going forward to try to tap into that, you know, to re-energize the global economy with that type of opportunistic and whatever you want to call it, you know, yeah, spirit that enabled us to be as productive as we were.
So, I mean, look, if appointed, I will not run, or if nominated, I will not run, if elected, I will not serve, right? I can't do it is the simple answer, right? There's too many unknown pieces in a puzzle. And so if I'm trying to architect that system, all I can do is say, the most important thing is to actually allow these signals to hit the private sector and allow other individuals to receive those signals and profit from the prosecution of them. We're not doing that in the West. And the corruption that we've had in capitalism, converting it to crony capitalism, the degree of monopolization, the encouragement of monopolization, and the fragility in the system, these are all problems that we need to address, right? So paradoxically, we need more government intervention to introduce competition and introduce robustness to the system by reducing reliance on dominant systems, right? Think about it in purely, you know, evolutionary terms, right? We are approaching a dead end of Google as the dominant search engine. We're approaching an end of Microsoft as the dominant, you know, operating system, et cetera. We need to recognize that some of those need to be changed. And I would go even further and point out things like passive investing, right? Which people can tune into any number of things for discussions around the corrosive effect of the monopoly that has emerged in that framework and the lobbying and regulatory capture around it. So if I'm going to change that something, I'm perversely actually going to encourage government intervention to drive increased innovation and competition.
Got it. Almost the way you're saying, it's more like, you know, give some teeth to the regulators to do their job, to break up, you know, monopolistic tendency.
Right. You're being sold a bill of goods right now, right? It's the same thing that if we break up AT&T, that we're not going to be able to get adequate telecom services, et cetera, right? That's just not what happens. What you actually do is you liberate unbelievable resources. We're massively abusing our patent law system. We're massively abusing our intellectual property system. We're massively abusing our system of taxation on an international basis. We know all this and we're terrified to react to it because we're just so frightened of change.
All right. Well, I'm literally biting my tongue super hard here because there's so much I want to ask you, but we've got to bring it to an end here. I know you don't want the role, but I think given what you just laid out there, Mike, I think you just basically won the audience's vote for our next emperor. So look, last question here for you, which is for folks that have really enjoyed this discussion and would like to follow you and your work, where should they go?
Easiest place to find me is on Twitter at ProfPlum99. You can also find me on the Simplify website, www.simplify.us. And if you're not exhausted at that point, just Google my name. You'll find any number of writings, speeches, opinion pieces that I've written for Barry Weiss or others. My Medium channel has limited amounts of writing, et cetera. I would largely argue I'm massively overexposed, and you'd have a harder time not finding me than finding me at this point.
All right. Well, look, Mike, when we edit this, we'll put up the URLs to your Twitter handle and Simplify and whatnot, so folks can easily find you. All right, folks. Well, look, just in wrapping up here, Mike and I covered an awful lot of territory in this discussion. Mike was super generous with his time to go this long. I assume, most people are trying to wrap their heads around a lot of the issues we talked about and wondering, okay, how do I prepare for what's ahead in the markets here and not become collateral damage to these many swirling forces that Mike and I have discussed. I just want to remind folks, very tumultuous, confusing time for the average investor. That's why we at Wealthion just reinforce every week that we think that you're much better off facing that under the guidance and tutelage of a professional financial advisor who understands the macro issues and risks that Mike and I talked about here. If you've got a good one, great, stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion of one who does, consider talking to one of the ones that Wealthion endorses. They're the guys you see with me on this channel every week. To go fill out a form to have a free consultation with those guys, just go to Wealthion.com, fill out that quick form, only takes you a couple of seconds. Totally free, no commitment to work with them. It's just offered as a public service. We are continuing my practice of writing down my key takeaways from each of these interviews. I've gotten an awful lot from this one with Mike. So if you want to go read my notes for free, just go to Wealthion.com/Adam's notes and you can read them there. And if you'd like to see Mike back on this program again in the future and other great guests like him, please help support this channel by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Mike, I want to thank you once again for coming on the program, giving us so much of your time, but so many great insights as well.
It was really a pleasure, Adam. Always enjoy it.
All right. Thanks so much, Mike. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.